In this tragedy, for example, he found fault with the ideas, but admired the style. He detested the conception, but applauded all the details, and loathed the characters, while he grew enthusiastic over their dialogue. When he read the fine passages, he was transported. But when he thought that mummers would get something out of them for their show, he was disconsolate. And in this confusion of sentiments in which he was involved, he would have liked at once to crown Racine with both his hands and discuss with him for a good quarter of an hour. At last, Emma remembered that at the Chateau of Vaubyessard she had heard the Marchioness call a young lady Berthe. From that moment, this name was chosen, and as old Rouault could not come, Monsieur Homais was requested to stand godfather. His gifts were all products from his establishment, to wit, 6 boxes of jujubes, a whole jar of racahou, 3 cakes of marshmallow paste, and 6 sticks of sugar candy into the bargain that he had come across in a cupboard. On the evening of the ceremony there was a grand dinner. The curé was present. There was much excitement. Monsieur Homais, towards liqueur time, began singing Le Dieu des Bonnes Gens. Monsieur Léon sang a barcarolle, and Madame Bovary Senior, who was godmother, a romance of the time of the Empire. Finally, Monsieur Bovary Senior insisted on having the child brought down, and began baptizing it with a glass of champagne that he poured over its head. This mockery of the first of the sacraments made the Abbé Bournisien angry. Old Bovary replied by a quotation from La Guerre des Dieux. The curé wanted to leave. The ladies implored, Homais interfered, and they succeeded in making the priest sit down again, and he quietly went on with the half-finished coffee in his saucer. Monsieur Bovary Senior stayed at Yonville a month, dazzling the natives by a superb policeman's cap with silver tassels that he wore in the morning when he smoked his pipe in the square. Being also in the habit of drinking a good deal of brandy, he often sent the servant to the Lion d'Or to buy him a bottle, which was put down to his son's account, and to perfume his handkerchiefs he used up his daughter-in-law's whole supply of eau de cologne. The latter did not at all dislike his company. He had knocked about the world, he talked about Berlin, Vienna, and Strasbourg, of his soldier times, of the mistresses he had had, the grand luncheons of which he had partaken. Then he was amiable, and sometimes even, either on the stairs or in the garden, would seize hold of her waist, crying, "Charles, look out for yourself!" Then Madame Bovary Senior became alarmed for her son's happiness, and fearing that her husband might in the long run have an immoral influence upon the ideas of the young woman, took care to hurry their departure. Perhaps she had more serious reasons for uneasiness. Monsieur Bovary was not the man to respect anything. One day, Emma was suddenly seized with the desire to see her little girl, who had been put to nurse with the carpenter's wife. And without looking at the almanac to see whether the 6 weeks of the Virgin were yet past, she set out for the Rollet's house, situated at the extreme end of the village, between the high road and the fields. It was midday. The shutters of the houses were closed, and the slate roofs that glittered beneath the fierce light of the blue sky seemed to strike sparks from the crest of their gables. A heavy wind was blowing. Emma felt weak as she walked. The stones of the pavement hurt her. She was doubtful whether she would not go home again or go in somewhere to rest. At this moment, Monsieur Léon came out from a neighbouring door with a bundle of papers under his arm. He came to greet her, and stood in the shade in front of Lheureux's shop under the projecting grey awning. Madame Bovary said she was going to see her baby, but that she was beginning to grow tired. "If," said Léon, not daring to go on. "Have you any business to attend to?" she asked. And on the clerk's answer she begged him to accompany her. That same evening this was known in Yonville, and Madame Tuvache, the mayor's wife, declared in the presence of her servant that Madame Bovary was compromising herself. To get to the nurse's it was necessary to turn to the left on leaving the street, as if making for the cemetery, and to follow between little houses and yards a small path bordered with privet hedges. They were in bloom, and so were the speedwells, eglantines, thistles, and the sweetbriar that sprang up from the thickets. Through openings in the hedge one could see into the huts, some pigs on a dung heap, or tethered cows rubbing their horns against the trunk of trees. The two, side by side, walked slowly, she leaning upon him and he restraining his pace, which he regulated by hers. In front of them a swarm of midges fluttered, buzzing in the warm air. They recognised the house by an old walnut tree which shaded it. Low and covered with brown tiles, there hung outside it, beneath the dormer window of the garret, a string of onions. Faggots, upright against a thorn fence, surrounded a bed of lettuces, a few square feet of lavender, and sweet peas strung on sticks. Dirty water was running here and there on the grass, and all round were several indefinite rags, knitted stockings, a red calico jacket, and a large sheet of coarse linen spread over the hedge. At the noise of the gate, the nurse appeared, with a baby she was suckling on one arm. With her other hand she was pulling along a poor puny little fellow, his face covered with scrofula, the son of a Rouen hosier, whom his parents, too taken up with their business, left in the country. "Go in," she said. "Your little one is there asleep." The room on the ground floor, the only one in the dwelling, had at its farther end against the wall a large bed without curtains, while a kneading trough took up the side by the window, one pane of which was mended with a piece of blue paper. In the corner behind the door, shining hobnailed shoes stood in a row under the slab of the washstand, near a bottle of oil with a feather stuck in its mouth. A Mathieu Landsberg lay on the dusty mantelpiece amid gunflints, candle ends and bits of amadou. Finally, the last luxury in the apartment was a Fame blowing her trumpets, a picture cut out, no doubt, from some perfumer's prospectus and nailed to the wall with six wooden shoe pegs. Emma's child was asleep in a wicker cradle. She took it up in the wrapping that enveloped it and began singing softly as she rocked herself to and fro. Léon walked up and down the room. It seemed strange to him to see this beautiful woman in her nankeen dress in the midst of all this poverty. Madame Bovary reddened. He turned away, thinking perhaps there had been an impertinent look in his eyes. Then she put back the little girl who had just been sick over her collar. The nurse at once came to dry her, protesting that it wouldn't show. "She gives me other doses," she said. "I'm always a washing of her. If you would have the goodness to order Camus the grocer to let me have a little soap, it would really be more convenient for you, as I needn't trouble you then." "Very well, very well," said Emma. "Good morning, Madame Rollet." And she went out, wiping her shoes at the door. The good woman accompanied her to the end of the garden, talking all the time of the trouble she had getting up of nights. "I'm that worn out sometimes as I drop asleep on my chair. I'm sure you might at least give me just a pound of ground coffee. That'd last me a month, and I'd take it of a morning with some milk." After having submitted to her thanks, Madame Bovary left. She had gone a little way down the path when, at the sound of wooden shoes, she turned round. It was the nurse. "What is it?" Then the peasant woman, taking her aside behind an elm tree, began talking to her of her husband, who, with his trade and 6 francs a year that the captain— "Oh, be quick," said Emma. "Well," the nurse went on, heaving sighs between each word, "I'm afraid he'll be put out seeing me have coffee alone, you know, men." "But you are to have some," Emma repeated. "I will give you some. You bother me." "Oh, dear, my poor dear lady. You see, in consequence of his wounds, he has terrible cramps in the chest. He even says that cider weakens him. Do make haste, Mère Rollet." "Well," the latter continued, making a curtsy, "if it weren't asking too much," and she curtsied once more, "if you would," and her eyes begged. "A jar of brandy," she said at last, "and I'll rub your little one's feet with it. They're as tender as one's tongue." Once rid of the nurse, Emma again took Monsieur Léon's arm. She walked fast for some time, then more slowly, and looking straight in front of her, her eyes rested on the shoulder of the young man, whose frock coat had a black velvet collar. His brown hair fell over it, straight and carefully arranged. She noticed his nails, which were longer than one wore them at Yonville. It was one of the clerk's chief occupations to trim them, and for this purpose he kept a special knife in his writing desk. They returned to Yonville by the waterside. In the warm season, the banks, wider than at other times, showed to their foot the garden walls, whence a few steps led to the river. It flowed noiselessly, swift and cold to the eyes. Long, thin grasses huddled together in it as the current drove them, and spread themselves upon the limpid water like streaming hair. Sometimes, at the top of the reeds or on the leaf of a water lily, an insect with fine legs crawled or rested. The sun pierced with a ray the small blue bubbles of the waves that, breaking, followed each other. Branchless old willows mirrored their grey backs in the water. Beyond, all around, the meadows seemed empty. It was the dinner hour at the farms, and the young woman and her companion heard nothing as they walked but the fall of their steps on the earth of the path, the words they spoke, and the sound of Emma's dress rustling round her. The walls of the gardens, with pieces of bottle on their coping, were hot as the glass windows of a conservatory. Wallflowers had sprung up between the bricks, and with the tip of her open sunshade, Madame Bovary, as she passed, made some of their faded flowers crumble into a yellow dust, or a spray of overhanging honeysuckle and clematis caught in its fringe and dangled for a moment over the silk. They were talking of a troupe of Spanish dancers who were expected shortly at the Rouen Theatre. "Are you going?" she asked. "If I can," he answered. Had they nothing else to say to one another? Yet their eyes were full of more serious speech, and while they forced themselves to find trivial phrases, they felt the same languor stealing over them both. It was the whisper of the soul, deep, continuous, dominating that of their voices. Surprised with wonder at this strange sweetness, they did not think of speaking of the sensation or of seeking its cause. Coming joys, like tropical shores, throw over the immensity before them their inborn softness and odorous wind, and we are lulled by this intoxication without a thought of the horizon that we do not even know. In one place the ground had been trodden down by the cattle. They had to step on large green stones put here and there in the mud. She often stopped a moment to look where to place her foot, and tottering on the stone that shook, her arms outspread, her form bent forward with a look of indecision, she would laugh, afraid of falling into the puddles of water. When they arrived in front of her garden, Madame Bovary opened the little gate, ran up the steps, and disappeared. Léon returned to his office. His chief was away. He just glanced at the briefs, then cut himself a pen, and at last took up his hat and went out. He went to La Pâture at the top of the Argueil hills at the beginning of the forest. He threw himself upon the ground under the pines and watched the sky through his fingers. "How bored I am," he said to himself. "How bored I am." He thought he was to be pitied for living in this village, with Homais for a friend and Monsieur Guillaumin for master. The latter, entirely absorbed by his business, wearing gold-rimmed spectacles and red whiskers over a white cravat, understood nothing of mental refinements, although he affected a stiff English manner which in the beginning had impressed the clerk. As to the chemist's spouse, she was the best wife in Normandy, gentle as a sheep, loving her children, her father, her mother, her cousins, weeping for others' woes, letting everything go in her household and detesting corsets, but so slow of movement, such a bore to listen to, so common in appearance and of such restricted conversation, that although she was 30, he only 20, although they slept in rooms next each other and he spoke to her daily, he never thought that she might be a woman for another, or that she possessed anything else of her sex than the gown. And what else was there? Binet, a few shopkeepers, two or three publicans, the curé, and finally Monsieur Tuvache, the mayor, with his two sons, rich, crabbed, obtuse persons who farmed their own lands and had feasts among themselves, bigoted to boot and quite unbearable companions. But from the general background of all these human faces, Emma's stood out, isolated and yet farthest off, for between her and him he seemed to see a vague abyss. In the beginning he had called on her several times along with the druggist. Charles had not appeared particularly anxious to see him again, and Léon did not know what to do, between his fear of being indiscreet and the desire for an intimacy that seemed almost impossible. Chapter 4. When the first cold days set in, Emma left her bedroom for the sitting room, a long apartment with a low ceiling, in which there was on the mantelpiece a large bunch of coral spread out against the looking-glass. Seated in her armchair near the window, she could see the villagers pass along the pavement. Twice a day, Léon went from his office to the Lion d'Or. Emma could hear him coming from afar. She leant forward, listening, and the young man glided past the curtain, always dressed in the same way and without turning his head. But in the twilight, when, her chin resting on her left hand, she let the embroidery she had begun fall on her knees, she often shuddered at the apparition of this shadow suddenly gliding past. She would get up and order the table to be laid. Monsieur Romay called at dinner-time. Skullcap in hand, he came in on tiptoe in order to disturb no one, always repeating the same phrase, "Good evening, everybody!" Then, when he had taken his seat at table between the pair, he asked the doctor about his patients, and the latter consulted him as to the probability of their payment. Next, they talked of what was in the paper. Homais, by this hour, knew it almost by heart, and he repeated it from end to end with the reflections of the penny a liners and all the stories of individual catastrophes that had occurred in France or abroad. But the subject becoming exhausted, he was not slow in throwing out some remarks on the dishes before him. Sometimes even, half rising, he delicately pointed out to Madame the tenderest morsel, or, turning to the servant, gave her some advice on the manipulation of stews and the hygiene of seasoning. He talked aroma, osmosome, juices, and gelatin in a bewildering manner. Moreover, Homais, with his head fuller of recipes than his shop of jars, excelled in making all kinds of preserves, vinegars, and sweet liqueurs. He knew also all the latest inventions in economic stoves, together with the art of preserving cheeses and of curing sick wines. At 8 o'clock, Justin came to fetch him to shut up the shop. Then Monsieur Homais gave him a sly look, especially if Félicité was there, for he had noticed that his apprentice was fond of the doctor's house. "The young dog," he said, "is beginning to have ideas, and the devil take me if I don't believe he's in love with your servant." But a more serious fault with which he reproached Justin was his constantly listening to conversation. On Sunday, for example, one could not get him out of the drawing-room, whither Madame Romais had called him to fetch the children, who were falling asleep in the armchairs and dragging down, with their backs, calico chair-covers that were too large. Not many people came to these soirées at the chemist's, his scandal-mongering and political opinions having successfully alienated various respectable persons from him. The clerk never failed to be there. As soon as he heard the bell, he ran to meet Madame Bovary, took her shawl, and put away under the shop-counter the thick list shoes that she wore over her boots when there was snow. First, they played some hands at Trente et Un. Next, Monsieur Romay played écarté with Emma. Léon, behind her, gave her advice. Standing up, with his hands on the back of her chair, he saw the teeth of her comb that bit into her chignon. With every movement that she made to throw her cards, the right side of her dress was drawn up. From her turned-up hair a dark colour fell over her back, and, growing gradually paler, lost itself little by little in the shade. Then her dress fell on both sides of her chair, puffing out full of folds, and reached the ground. When Léon occasionally felt the sole of his boot resting on it, he drew back as if he had trodden upon someone. When the game of cards was over, the druggist and the doctor played dominoes, and Emma, changing her place, leant her elbow on the table, turning over the leaves of L'Illustration. She had brought her lady's journal with her. Léon sat down near her. They looked at the engravings together and waited for one another at the bottom of the pages. She often begged him to read her the verses. Léon declaimed them in a languid voice to which he carefully gave a dying fall in the love passages. But the noise of the dominoes annoyed him. Monsieur Homais was strong at the game. He could beat Charles and give him a double six. Then, the 300 finished, they both stretched themselves out in front of the fire and were soon asleep. The fire was dying out in the cinders, the teapot was empty, Léon was still reading. Emma listened to him, mechanically turning round the lampshade, on the gauze of which were painted clowns in carriages and tightrope dancers with their balancing poles. Léon stopped, pointing with a gesture to his sleeping audience. Then they talked in low tones, and their conversation seemed the more sweet to them because it was unheard. Thus a kind of bond was established between them, a constant commerce of books and of romances. Monsieur Bovary, little given to jealousy, did not trouble himself about it. On his birthday he received a beautiful phrenological head, all marked with figures to the thorax and painted blue. This was an attention of the clerk's. He showed him many others, even to doing errands for him at Rouen. And the book of a novelist, having made the mania for cactuses fashionable, Léon bought some for Madame Bovary, bringing them back on his knees in the Hirondelle, pricking his fingers with their hard hairs. She had a board with a balustrade fixed against her window to hold the pots. The clerk, too, had his small hanging garden. They saw each other, tending their flowers at their windows. Of the windows of the village, there was one yet more often occupied, for on Sundays from morning to night, and every morning when the weather was bright, one could see at the dormer window of a garret the profile of Monsieur Binet bending over his lathe, whose monotonous humming could be heard at the Lyon door. One evening, on coming home, Léon found in his room a rug in velvet and wool with leaves on a pale ground. He called Madame Homais, Monsieur Homais, Justin, the children, the cook. He spoke of it to his chief. Everyone wanted to see this rug. Why did the doctor's wife give the clerk presents? It looked queer. They decided that she must be his lover. He made this seem likely, so ceaselessly did he talk of her charms and of her wit, so much so that Binet once roughly answered him, "What does it matter to me since I'm not in her set?" He tortured himself to find out how he could make his declaration to her, and always halting between the fear of displeasing her and the shame of being such a coward, he wept with discouragement and desire. Then he took energetic resolutions, wrote letters that he tore up, put it off to times that he again deferred. Often he set out with the determination to dare all, but this resolution soon deserted him in Emma's presence, and when Charles, dropping in, invited him to jump into his chaise to go with him to see some patient in the neighbourhood, he at once accepted, bowed to Madame, and went out. Her husband, was he not something belonging to her? As to Emma, she did not ask herself whether she loved. Love, she thought, must come suddenly with great outbursts and lightnings, a hurricane of the skies which falls upon life, revolutionizes it, roots up the will like a leaf, and sweeps the whole heart into the abyss. She did not know that on the terrace of houses it makes lakes when the pipes are choked, and she would thus have remained in her security when she suddenly discovered a rent in the wall of it. Chapter 5. It was a Sunday in February, an afternoon when the snow was falling. They had all, Monsieur and Madame Bovary, Homais and Monsieur Léon, gone to see a yarn mill that was being built in the valley a mile and a half from Yonville. The druggist had taken Napoleon and Athalie to give them some exercise, and Justin accompanied them, carrying the umbrellas on his shoulder. Nothing, however, could be less curious than this curiosity. A great piece of waste ground, on which pell-mell, amid a mass of sand and stones, were a few brake wheels, already rusty, surrounded by a quadrangular building pierced by a number of little windows. The building was unfinished, the sky could be seen through the joists of the roofing. Attached to the stop plank of the gable, a bunch of straw mixed with corn ears fluttered its tricoloured ribbons in the wind. Homais was talking. He explained to the company the future importance of this establishment, computed the strength of the floorings, the thickness of the walls, and regretted extremely not having a yardstick such as Monsieur Binet possessed for his own special use. Emma, who had taken his arm, bent lightly against his shoulder, and she looked at the sun's disk shedding afar through the mist his pale splendour. She turned. Charles was there. His cap was drawn down over his eyebrows, and his two thick lips were trembling, which added a look of stupidity to his face. His very back, his calm back, was irritating to behold, and she saw, written upon his coat, all the platitude of the bearer. While she was considering him thus, tasting in her irritation a sort of depraved pleasure, Léon made a step forward. The cold that made him pale seemed to add a more gentle languor to his face. Between his cravat and his neck, the somewhat loose collar of his shirt showed the skin. The lobe of his ear looked out from beneath a lock of hair, and his large blue eyes, raised to the clouds, seemed to Emma more limpid and more beautiful than those mountain lakes where the heavens are mirrored. "Wretched boy!" suddenly cried the chemist, and he ran to his son, who had just precipitated himself into a heap of lime in order to whiten his boots. At the reproaches with which he was being overwhelmed, Napoleon began to roar, while Justin dried his shoes with a wisp of straw. But a knife was wanted. Charles offered his. "Ah," she said to herself, "he carries a knife in his pocket like a peasant." The hoar frost was falling, and they turned back to Yonville. In the evening, Madame Bovary did not go to her neighbours, and when Charles had left and she felt herself alone, the comparison re-began with the clearness of a sensation almost actual, and with that lengthening of perspective which memory gives to things. Looking from her bed at the clean fire that was burning, she still saw, as she had down there, Léon standing up with one hand bending his cane, and with the other holding Athalie, who was quietly sucking a piece of ice. She thought him charming. She could not tear herself away from him. She recalled his other attitudes on other days, the words he had spoken, the sound of his voice, his whole person. And she repeated, pouting out her lips as if for a kiss, "Yes, charming, charming. Is he not in love?" she asked herself. "But with whom? With me?" All the proofs arose before her at once. Her heart leapt. The flame of the fire threw a joyous light upon the ceiling. She turned on her back, stretching out her arms. Then began the eternal lamentation. Oh, if heaven had but willed it! And why not? What prevented it? When Charles came home at midnight, she seemed to have just awakened, and as he made a noise undressing, she complained of a headache, then asked carelessly what had happened that evening. "Monsieur Léon," he said, "went to his room early." She could not help smiling, and she fell asleep, her soul filled with a new delight. The next day, at dusk, she received a visit from Monsieur Lheureux, the draper. He was a man of ability, was this shopkeeper. Born a Gascon, but bred a Norman, he grafted upon his southern volubility the cunning of the cauchois. His fat, flabby, beardless face seemed dyed by a decoction of licorice, and his white hair made even more vivid the keen brilliance of his small black eyes. No one knew what he had been formerly. "A peddler," said some. "A banker at Routot," according to others. What was certain was that he made complex calculations in his head that would have frightened Binet himself. Polite to obsequiousness, he always held himself with his back bent in the position of one who bows or who invites. After leaving at the door his hat surrounded with crepe, he put down a green bandbox on the table, and began by complaining to Madame, with many civilities, that he should have remained till that day without gaining her confidence. A poor shop like his was not made to attract a fashionable lady. He emphasized the words. Yet she had only to command, and he would undertake to provide her with anything she might wish, either in haberdashery or linen, millinery or fancy goods, for he went to town regularly 4 times a month. He was connected with the best houses. You could speak of him at the Trois Frères, at the Barbe d'Or, or at the Grand Sauvage. All these gentlemen knew him as well as the insides of their pockets. Today, then, he had come to show Madame in passing various articles he happened to have, thanks to the most rare opportunity, and he pulled out 6 embroidered collars from the box. Madame Bovary examined them. "I do not require anything," she said. Then Monsieur Lheureux delicately exhibited 3 Algerian scarves, 7 packets of English needles, a pair of straw slippers, and finally 4 egg cups in coconut wood carved in openwork by convicts. Then, with both hands on the table, his neck stretched out, his figure bent forward, open-mouthed, he watched Emma's look, who was walking up and down undecided amid these goods. From time to time, as if to remove some dust, he filliped with his nail the silk of the scarves spread out at full length, and they rustled with a little noise, making in the green twilight the gold spangles of their tissues scintillate like little stars. "How much are they?" "A mere nothing," he replied, "a mere nothing. But there's no hurry, whenever it's convenient. We are not Jews." She reflected for a few moments, and ended by again declining Monsieur Lheureux's offer. He replied quite unconcernedly, "Very well, we shall understand one another by and by. I've always got on with ladies, if I didn't with my own." Emma smiled. "I wanted to tell you," he went on good-naturedly after his joke, "that it isn't the money I should trouble about. Why, I could give you some, if need be." She made a gesture of surprise. "Ah," said he quickly and in a low voice, "I shouldn't have to go far to find you some, rely on that." And he began asking after Père Tellier, the proprietor of the Café Français, whom Monsieur Bovary was then attending. "What's the matter with Père Tellier? He coughs so that he shakes his whole house, and I'm afraid he'll soon want a deal covering rather than a flannel vest. He was such a rake as a young man. Those sort of people, madame, have not the least regularity. He's burnt up with brandy. Still, it's sad, all the same, to see an acquaintance go off." And while he fastened up his box, he discoursed about the doctor's patients. "It's the weather, no doubt," he said, looking frowningly at the floor, "that causes these illnesses. I, too, don't feel the thing. One of these days I shall even have to consult the doctor for a pain I have in my back. Well, good-bye, Madame Bovary. At your service, your very humble servant." And he closed the door gently. Emma had her dinner served in her bedroom on a tray by the fireside. She was a long time over it. Everything was well with her. "How good I was," she said to herself, thinking of the scarves. She heard some steps on the stairs. It was Léon. She got up and took from the chest of drawers the first pile of dusters to be hemmed. When he came in, she seemed very busy. The conversation languished. Madame Bovary gave it up every few minutes, whilst he himself seemed quite embarrassed. Seated on a low chair near the fire, he turned round in his fingers the ivory thimble case. She stitched on, or from time to time turned down the hem of the cloth with her nail. She did not speak. He was silent, being as captivated by her silence as he would have been by her speech. "Poor fellow," she thought. "How have I displeased her?" he asked himself. At last, however, Léon said that he should have one of these days to go to Rouen on some office business. "Your music subscription is out. Am I to renew it?" "No," she replied. "Why?" "Because." And pursing her lips, she slowly drew a long stitch of grey thread. This work irritated Léon. It seemed to roughen the ends of her fingers. A gallant phrase came into his head, but he did not risk it. "Then you are giving it up?" he went on. "What?" she asked hurriedly. "Music. Ah, yes. Have I not my house to look after, my husband to attend to? A thousand things, in fact, many duties that must be considered first." She looked at the clock. Charles was late. Then she affected anxiety. Two or three times she even repeated, "He is so good." The clerk was fond of Monsieur Bovary, but this tenderness on his behalf astonished him unpleasantly. Nevertheless, he took up his praises, which he said everyone was singing, especially the chemist. "Ah, he is a good fellow," continued Emma. "Certainly," replied the clerk. And he began talking of Madame Homais, whose very untidy appearance generally made them laugh. "What does it matter?" interrupted Emma. "A good housewife does not trouble about her appearance." Then she relapsed into silence. It was the same on the following days. Her talks, her manners, everything changed. She took interest in the housework, went to church regularly, and looked after her servant with more severity. She took Berthe from nurse. When visitors called, Félicité brought her in, and Madame Bovary undressed her to show off her limbs. She declared she adored children. This was her consolation, her joy, her passion. And she accompanied her caresses with lyrical outbursts, which would have reminded anyone but the Yonville people of Sachette in Notre-Dame de Paris. When Charles came home, he found his slippers put to warm near the fire. His waistcoat now never wanted lining, nor his shirt buttons, and it was quite a pleasure to see in the cupboard the nightcaps arranged in piles of the same height. She no longer grumbled, as formerly, at taking a turn in the garden. What he proposed was always done, although she did not understand the wishes to which she submitted without a murmur. And when Leon saw him by his fireside after dinner, his two hands on his stomach, his 2 feet on the fender, his cheeks red with feeding, his eyes moist with happiness, the child crawling along the carpet, and this woman with the slender waist who came behind his armchair to kiss his forehead, what madness, he said to himself, and how to reach her! And thus she seemed so virtuous and inaccessible to him that he lost all hope, even the faintest. But by this renunciation he placed her on an extraordinary pinnacle. To him she stood outside those fleshly attributes from which he had nothing to obtain, and in his heart she rose ever and became farther removed from him, after the magnificent manner of an apotheosis that is taking wing. It was one of those pure feelings that do not interfere with life, that are cultivated because they are rare, and whose loss would afflict more than their passion rejoices. Emma grew thinner, her cheeks paler, her face longer. With her black hair, her large eyes, her aquiline nose, her bird-like walk, and always silent now, did she not seem to be passing through life scarcely touching it, and to bear on her brow the vague impress of some divine destiny? She was so sad and so calm, at once so gentle and so reserved, that near her one felt oneself seized by an icy charm, as we shudder in churches at the perfume of the flowers, mingling with the cold of the marble. The others even did not escape from this seduction. The chemist said, "She is a woman of great parts who wouldn't be misplaced in a sub-prefecture." The housewives admired her economy, the patients her politeness, the poor her charity. But she was eaten up with desires, with rage, with hate. That dress with the narrow folds hid a distracted heart, of whose torment those chaste lips said nothing. She was in love with Leon, and sought solitude that she might with the more ease delight in his image. The sight of his form troubled the voluptuousness of this meditation. Emma thrilled at the sound of his step. Then, in his presence, the emotion subsided, and afterwards there remained to her only an immense astonishment that ended in sorrow. Leon did not know that when he left her in despair, she rose after he had gone to see him in the street. She concerned herself about his comings and goings. She watched his face. She invented quite a history to find an excuse for going to his room. The chemist's wife seemed happy to her to sleep under the same roof, and her thoughts constantly centred upon this house, like the Leon d'Or pigeons who came there to dip their red feet and white wings in its gutters. But the more Emma recognised her love, the more she crushed it down, that it might not be evident that she might make it less. She would have liked Leon to guess it, and she imagined chances, catastrophes, that should facilitate this. What restrained her was, no doubt, idleness and fear, and a sense of shame also. She thought she had repulsed him too much, that the time was past, that all was lost. Then pride, the joy of being able to say to herself, "I am virtuous," and to look at herself in the glass, taking resigned poses, consoled her a little for the sacrifice she believed she was making. Then the lusts of the flesh, the longing for money, and the melancholy of passion, all blended themselves into one suffering, and instead of turning her thoughts from it, she clave to it the more, urging herself to pain, and seeking everywhere occasion for it. She was irritated by an ill-served dish or by a half-open door, bewailed the velvet she had not, the happiness she had missed, her two exalted dreams, her narrow home. What exasperated her was that Charles did not seem to notice her anguish. His conviction that he was making her happy seemed to her an imbecile insult, and his sureness on this point ingratitude. For whose sake, then, was she virtuous? Was it not for him, the obstacle to all felicity, the cause of all misery, and, as it were, the sharp clasp of that complex strap that buckled her in on all sides? On him alone, then, she concentrated all the various hatreds that resulted from her boredom, and every effort to diminish only augmented it, for this useless trouble was added to the other reasons for despair, and contributed still more to the separation between them. Her own gentleness to herself made her rebel against him. Domestic mediocrity drove her to lewd fancies, marriage tenderness to adulterous desires. She would have liked Charles to beat her, that she might have a better right to hate him, to revenge herself upon him. She was surprised sometimes at the atrocious conjectures that came into her thoughts, and she had to go on smiling, to hear repeated to her at all hours that she was happy, to pretend to be happy, to let it be believed. Yet she had loathing of this hypocrisy. She was seized with a temptation to flee somewhere with Leon to try a new life, but at once a vague chasm full of darkness opened within her soul. "Besides, he no longer loves me," she thought. "What is to become of me? What help is to be hoped for? What consolation? What solace?" She was left broken, breathless, inert, sobbing in a low voice with flowing tears. "Why don't you tell Master?" the servant asked her when she came in during these crises. "It is the nerves," said Emma. "Do not speak to him of it. It would worry him." "Oh, yes," Felicity went on, "you are just like La Guérine, Peg Aram's daughter, the fisherman at Pollet that I used to know at Dieppe before I came to you. She was so sad to see her standing upright on the threshold of her house. She seemed to you like a winding sheet spread out before the door. Her illness, it appears, was a kind of fog that she had in her head, and the doctors could not do anything, nor the priest either. When she was taken too bad, she went off quite alone to the seashore, so that the customs officer, going his rounds, often found her lying flat on her face, crying on the shingle. Then, after her marriage, it went off, they say." "But with me," replied Emma, "it was after marriage that it began." Chapter 6. One evening, when the window was open, and she, sitting by it, had been watching Lestiboudois, the beadle, trimming the box, she suddenly heard the Angelus ringing. It was the beginning of April, when the primroses are in bloom, and a warm wind blows over the flower-beds newly turned, and the gardens, like women, seem to be getting ready for the summer fetes. Through the bars of the arbour and away beyond, the river could be seen in the fields, meandering through the grass in wandering curves. The evening vapours rose between the leafless poplars, touching their outlines with a violet tint, paler and more transparent than a subtle gauze caught athwart their branches. In the distance cattle moved about. Neither their steps nor their lowing could be heard, and the bell, still ringing through the air, kept up its peaceful lamentation. With this repeated tinkling, the thoughts of the young woman lost themselves in old memories of her youth and schooldays. She remembered the great candlesticks that rose above the vases full of flowers on the altar, and the tabernacle with its small columns. She would have liked to be once more lost in the long line of white veils, marked off here and there by the stiff black hoods of the good sisters bending over their prie-dieu. At Mass on Sundays, when she looked up, she saw the gentle face of the Virgin amid the blue smoke of the rising incense. Then she was moved. She felt herself weak and quite deserted, like the down of a bird whirled by the tempest. And it was unconsciously that she went towards the church, inclined to no matter what devotions, so that her soul was absorbed and all existence lost in it. On the Place she met Lestiboudois on his way back, for in order not to shorten his day's labour, he preferred interrupting his work, then beginning it again, so that he rang the Angelus to suit his own convenience. Besides, the ringing over a little earlier warned the lads of catechism hour. Already a few who had arrived were playing marbles on the stones of the cemetery. Others astride the wall swung their legs, kicking with their clogs the large nettles growing between the little enclosure and the newest graves. This was the only green spot. All the rest was but stones, always covered with a fine powder, despite the vestry broom. The children in list shoes ran about there as if it were an enclosure made for them. The shouts of their voices could be heard through the humming of the bell. This grew less and less with the swinging of the great rope that, hanging from the top of the belfry, dragged its end on the ground. Swallows flitted to and fro, uttering little cries, cut the air with the edge of their wings, and swiftly returned to their yellow nests under the tiles of the coping. At the end of the church a lamp was burning, the wick of a nightlight in a glass hung up. Its light from a distance looked like a white stain trembling in the oil. A long ray of the sun fell across the nave and seemed to darken the lower sides and the corners. "Where is the curé?" asked Madame Bovary of one of the lads, who was amusing himself by shaking a swivel in a hole too large for it. "He's just coming," he answered. And, in fact, the door of the presbytery grated. Abbé Bournisien appeared. The children, pell-mell, fled into the church. "These young scamps," murmured the priest, "always the same." Then, picking up a catechism, all in rags, that he had struck with his foot, "They respect nothing." But as soon as he caught sight of Madame Bovary, "Excuse me," he said, "I did not recognize you." He thrust the catechism into his pocket and stopped short, balancing the heavy vestry key between his two fingers. The light of the setting sun that fell full upon his face paled the lasting of his cassock, shiny at the elbows, unravelled at the hem. Grease and tobacco stains followed along his broad chest the lines of the buttons, and grew more numerous the farther they were from his neckcloth, in which the massive folds of his red chin rested. This was dotted with yellow spots that disappeared beneath the coarse hair of his greyish beard. He had just dined and was breathing noisily. "How are you?" he added.
"Not well," replied Emma. "I am ill."
"Well, and so am I," answered the priest. "These first warm days weaken one most remarkably, don't they? But after all, we are born to suffer, as St. Paul says. But what does Monsieur Bovary think of it?"
"He," she said, with a gesture of contempt.
"What?" replied the good fellow, quite astonished. "Doesn't he prescribe something for you?"
"Ah," said Emma, "it is no earthly remedy I need."
But the curé, from time to time, looked into the church, where the kneeling boys were shouldering one another and tumbling over like packs of cards.
"I should like to know," she went on.
"You look out, Riboudet," cried the priest in an angry voice. "I'll warm your ears, you imp." Then, turning to Emma, "He's Boudet the carpenter's son. His parents are well off and let him do just as he pleases. Yet he could learn quickly if he would, for he is very sharp. And so sometimes, for a joke, I call him Riboudet, like the road one takes to go to Maromme, and I even say Mon Riboudet, ha ha, Mont Riboudet. The other day I repeated that jest to Monsignor, and he laughed at it. He condescended to laugh at it. And how is Monsieur Bovary?" She seemed not to hear him, and he went on. "Always very busy, no doubt, for he and I are certainly the busiest people in the parish. But he is doctor of the body," he added with a thick laugh, "and I of the soul." She fixed her pleading eyes upon the priest.
"Yes," she said, "you solace all sorrows."
"Oh, don't talk to me of it, Madame Bovary. This morning I had to go to Badioville for a cow that was ill. They thought it was under a spell. All their cows, I don't know how it is. But pardon me, Longuemare and Boudet, bless me, will you leave off?" And with a bound he ran into the church. The boys were just then clustering round the large desk, climbing over the precentor's footstool, opening the missal, and others on tiptoe were just about to venture into the confessional. But the priest suddenly distributed a shower of cuffs among them. Seizing them by the collars of their coats, he lifted them from the ground and deposited them on their knees on the stones of the choir, firmly, as if he meant planting them there. "Yes," said he, when he returned to Emma, unfolding his large cotton handkerchief, one corner of which he put between his teeth, "farmers are much to be pitied."
"Others too," she replied.
"Assuredly. Town labourers, for example."
"It is not they."
"Pardon, I've known their poor mothers of families, virtuous women, I assure you, real saints who wanted even bread."
"But those," replied Emma, and the corners of her mouth twitched as she spoke, "those, Monsieur la Curé, who have bread and have no
fire in the winter," said the priest.
"Oh, what does that matter?"
"What? What does it matter? It seems to me that when one has firing and food, for after all..."
"My God, my God," she sighed.
"Do you feel unwell?" he asked, approaching her anxiously. "It is indigestion, no doubt. You must get home, Madame Bovary. Drink a little tea, that will strengthen you, or else a glass of fresh water with a little moist sugar."
"Why?"
And she looked like one awaking from a dream.
"Well, you see, you were putting your hand to your forehead. I thought you felt faint."
Then, bethinking himself,
"But you were asking me something. What was it? I really don't remember."
"I? Nothing. Nothing," repeated Emma.
And the glance she cast round her slowly fell upon the old man in the cassock. They looked at one another face to face without speaking.
"Then, Madame Bovary," he said at last, "excuse me, but duty first, you know. I must look after my good-for-nothings. The First Communion will soon be upon us, and I fear we shall be behind after all. So after Ascension Day I keep them rector an extra hour every Wednesday. Poor children! One cannot lead them too soon into the path of the Lord, as, moreover, he has himself recommended us to do by the mouth of his divine Son. Good health to you, madame. My respects to your husband." And he went into the church, making a genuflection as soon as he reached the door. Emma saw him disappear between the double row of forms, walking with heavy tread, his head a little bent over his shoulder, and with his two hands half open behind him. Then she turned on her heel, all of one piece, like a statue on a pivot, and went homewards. But the loud voice of the priest, the clear voices of the boys, still reached her ears and went on behind her. "Are you a Christian?"
"Yes, I am a Christian."
"What is a Christian?"
"He who, being baptized.
She went up the steps of the staircase, holding on to the banisters, and when she was in her room, threw herself into an armchair. The whitish light of the window panes fell with soft undulations. The furniture in its place seemed to have become more immobile, and to lose itself in the shadow as in an ocean of darkness. The fire was out, the clock went on ticking, and Emma vaguely marvelled at this calm of all things, while within herself was such tumult. But little Berta was there, between the window and the work-table, tottering on her knitted shoes, and trying to come to her mother to catch hold of the ends of her apron-strings. "Leave me alone," said the latter, putting her from her with her hand. The little girl soon came up closer against her knees, and leaning on them with her arm, she looked up with her large blue eyes, while a small thread of pure saliva dribbled from her lips onto the silk apron. "Leave me alone!" repeated the young woman, quite irritably. Her face frightened the child, who began to scream. "Will you leave me alone?" she said, pushing her with her elbow. Berta fell at the foot of the drawers against the brass handle, cutting her cheek, which began to bleed, against it. Madame Bovary sprang to lift her up, broke the bell-rope, called for the servant with all her might, and she was just going to curse herself when Charles appeared. It was the dinner hour. He had come home.
"Look, dear," said Emma, in a calm voice. "The little one fell down while she was playing and has hurt herself."
Charles reassured her the case was not a serious one, and he went for some sticking plaster. Madame Bovary did not go downstairs to the dining-room. She wished to remain alone to look after the child. Then, watching her sleep, the little anxiety she felt gradually wore off, and she seemed very stupid to herself, and very good to have been so worried just now at so little. Berta, in fact, no longer sobbed. Her breathing now imperceptibly raised the cotton covering. Big tears lay in the corner of the half-closed eyelids, through whose lashes one could see two pale, sunken pupils. The plaster, stuck on her cheek, drew the skin obliquely. "It is very strange," thought Emma, "how ugly this child is." When at 11 o'clock Charles came back from the chemist's shop, whither he had gone after dinner to return the remainder of the sticking plaster, he found his wife standing by the cradle.
"I assure you it's nothing," he said, kissing her on the forehead. "Don't worry, my poor darling. You will make yourself ill."
He had stayed a long time at the chemist's. Although he had not seemed much moved, Homais nevertheless had exerted himself to buoy him up, to keep up his spirits. Then they had talked of the various dangers that threatened childhood, of the carelessness of servants. Madame Homais knew something of it, having still upon her chest the marks left by a basinful of soup that a cook had formerly dropped on her pinafore, and her good parents took no end of trouble for her. The knives were not sharpened, nor the floors waxed. There were iron gratings to the windows and strong bars across the fireplace.
The little Homais, in spite of their spirit, could not stir without someone watching them. At the slightest cold, their father stuffed them with pectorals, and until they were turned 4, they all, without pity, had to wear wadded head protectors. This, it is true, was a fancy of Madame Homais. Her husband was inwardly afflicted at it. Fearing the possible consequences of such compression to the intellectual organs, he even went so far as to say to her, "Do you want to make caribs or botocudos of them?" Charles, however, had several times tried to interrupt the conversation. "I should like to speak to you," he had whispered in the clerk's ear, who went upstairs in front of him. "Can he suspect anything?" Léon asked himself. His heart beat, and he racked his brain with surmises. At last, Charles, having shut the door, asked him to see himself what would be the price at Rouen of a fine daguerreotype. It was a sentimental surprise he intended for his wife, a delicate attention, his portrait in a frock coat. But he wanted first to know how much it would be. The inquiries would not put Monsieur Léon out, since he went to town almost every week. Why? Monsieur Homais suspected some young man's affair at the bottom of it, an intrigue. But he was mistaken. Léon was after no love-making. He was sadder than ever, as Madame Lefrançois saw from the amount of food he left on his plate. To find out more about it, she questioned the tax collector. Binet answered roughly that he wasn't paid by the police. All the same, his companion seemed very strange to him, for Léon often threw himself back in his chair and, stretching out his arms, complained vaguely of life. "It's because you don't take enough recreation," said the collector. "What recreation? If I were you, I'd have a lathe." "But I don't know how to turn," answered the clerk. "Ah, that's true," said the other, rubbing his chin with an air of mingled contempt and satisfaction. Léon was weary of loving without any result. Moreover, he was beginning to feel that depression caused by the repetition of the same kind of life, when no interest inspires and no hope sustains it. He was so bored with Yonville and the Yonvillers that the sight of certain persons of certain houses irritated him beyond endurance, and the chemist, good fellow though he was becoming absolutely unbearable to him. Yet the prospect of a new condition of life frightened as much as it seduced him. This apprehension soon changed into impatience. And then Paris, from afar, sounded its fanfare of masked balls with the laugh of grisettes. As he was to finish reading there, why not set out at once? What prevented him? And he began making home preparations. He arranged his occupations beforehand. He furnished in his head an apartment. He would lead an artist's life there. He would take lessons on the guitar. He would have a dressing gown, a basque cap, blue velvet slippers. He even already was admiring 2 crossed foils over his chimney-piece with a death's head on the guitar above them. The difficulty was the consent of his mother. Nothing, however, seemed more reasonable. Even his employer advised him to go to some other chambers where he could advance more rapidly. Taking a middle course, then, Léon looked for some place as second clerk at Rouen, found none, and at last wrote his mother a long letter full of details, in which he set forth the reasons for going to live at Paris immediately. She consented. He did not hurry. Every day for a month, Hivert carried boxes, valises, parcels for him from Yonville to Rouen and from Rouen to Yonville, and when Léon had packed up his wardrobe, had his 3 armchairs restuffed, bought a stock of neckties, in a word, had made more preparations than for a voyage round the world, he put it off from week to week, until he received a second letter from his mother urging him to leave, since he wanted to pass his examination before the vacation. When the moment for the farewells had come, Madame Homais wept. Justin sobbed. Homais, as a man of nerve, concealed his emotion. He wished to carry his friend's overcoat himself as far as the gate of the notary, who was taking Léon to Rouen in his carriage. The latter had just time to bid farewell to Monsieur Bovary. When he reached the head of the stairs, he stopped. He was so out of breath. On his coming in, Madame Bovary rose hurriedly. "It is I again," said Léon. "I was sure of it." She bit her lips, and a rush of blood flowing under her skin made her red from the roots of her hair to the top of her collar. She remained standing, leaning with her shoulder against the wainscot. "The doctor is not here?" he went on. "He is out," she repeated. "He is out." Then there was silence. They looked one at the other, and their thoughts, confounded in the same agony, clung close together like two throbbing breasts. "I should like to kiss Berta," said Leon. Emma went down a few steps.